Welcome to the Literacy Works podcast hosted by Bedrock Learning. I'm Andy Sammons, the head of teaching and learning at Bedrock. And in today's podcast, we have Marcello Giovanelli. I wanted to hunt him down from the day we started the podcast to ask him to come on. So thank you so much for coming on. I can't even imagine how busy you are. Marcello is a name on one of my A-level textbooks from years ago, and he obviously is a well-known name in A-level language teaching, but I think his reach is starting to go beyond that. So before I bore you anymore, I just, you know, with my words here, Marcello, could you give us a bit of an into, you know, who you are and what your role is and what you're focused on at the moment?
Yeah, thanks, Andy. No problem at all. So I'm actually a reader in literary linguistics at Aston University. Where I'm also the head of English languages and applied linguistics. So the bulk of my work really is in taking linguistic models and theories and ideas and applying them to understanding literature. So that's literary linguistics, sometimes known as stylistics. That's my research area. I guess I've always been interested in, well, I see myself first and foremost as a linguist. I don't really see myself as a literary scholar.
Interesting, okay.
I guess that's the important distinction to make. And, you know, my love of language, really, and certainly my commitment to seeing language as at the heart of the English curriculum goes back a long way to probably starting when I was an English teacher myself. I spent the first 11 years of my career as a secondary teacher. I was a head of English, assistant head teacher, head of sixth form, deputy head teacher at the end. For 11 years. And, you know, that sense of what English is a very difficult subject, I think, in HE and in secondary and in primary, but certainly in secondary, there's a lot of tension between the perception of there being a language bit and a literature bit. I've always frowned upon that and thought that was a very sort of misguided compartmentalization. So I've always championed really, you know, seeing language and literature as part of the same thing, and certainly seeing language as probably the best way to access literature, actually, and talk and teach about literature, because after all, literary texts are made out of, are formed from language. And I think what we know from modern linguistics is really, really useful to help us think about literary texts. That's kind of where I've come from, I guess. And I've been in higher education now for 14 years, so a bit longer than I was in secondary education, but I don't think I've ever lost that interest in the school side as well.
It's interesting because I'm a language A-level teacher, kind of, that's what I did. I did linguistics universities very similarly, and I've played with the language and literature A-level course and just notionally I like the idea of that more than the two separate courses, because I think using linguistics to understand the texts themselves, that should be where we're striving to, I think. So and more recently you've written a book with Jennifer Webb, haven't you, Essential Grammar. How did that come about, and what was the kind of the idea behind that? And what is the book, basically?
Yeah, it's really interesting. First of all, it was a great book to work on. One of my favourite things I've ever done. And Jenny is amazingly talented and wonderful. And I learned a tremendous amount from working with her as well. So it's a really good experience. I think we met about 4 or 5 years ago when she was a keynote at the Team English conference in Peterborough.
Was it the one in Peterborough?
I think it was Peterborough. It was pre-COVID. And she was a keynote, and I did a session there. And so we sort of got to know each other from talking about the sessions of each other we attended. And then about a year later, I'm not quite sure how, but we again ended up talking to each other and suggested that we might work on a grammar book together. That sort of brought the HE parts, or the linguistics part, from me, and then the more practical awareness of schools agenda that Jenny brings, and of course she's got some wonderful thinking as well about sort of structuring teaching and curriculum, and also the importance of senior leadership teams being involved in curricular design and so forth. So we started from very, very different places, and I think we probably, in many ways, didn't really always understand the other other's position. But by the end, it really felt like a compromise of ideas, and a very positive compromise of ideas as well, because that book certainly wouldn't have looked the way it did had I written it on my own, and I don't think it would have looked the way it did had she written it on her own. So it was a great example of two people coming together and really working, productively together to put something that couldn't have existed without both of them. So it was a great book.
And what do you think you did achieve with the book then? Because I've read parts of it and I think it's great. Yeah. But from the author's perspective, what do you think that compromise was?
I mean, for me, the most important thing is always, helping teachers, or hopefully helping teachers and students to see the importance of language as a thing to study in its own right, but as a thing to study that is important to help them do what they need to do, which is, study text and pass exams and the rest of it. I think what Jenny brought to the project, and what she did really well, is also convince teachers of some of the broader scope to that as well. So, for example, grammar for writing, grammar for academic language, threading ideas around grammar and language through the curriculum. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned a few moments ago, the importance of senior leaders being on board and understanding the importance of the sorts of things that we were talking about. And she writes from that position now, which I don't, of course. I mean, that, for me, that's a long time ago. So I think we kind of captured lots of different audiences, teachers who might be really into language but just wanted a decent resource, teachers who were a bit scared of it and wanted something to help them, teachers who were heads of English who perhaps wanted to know a bit more how it might all fit together, and then senior leaders who were looking at how that aspect of English might inform schemes of work, programs of study more broadly as well. So it felt like a neat book that did lots of things. And I should add, should have said this at the beginning, we were very clear in the book that when we talk about grammar, because one of the issues with grammar is it can be quite a scary, off-putting word, that we were really talking about what we were calling, and it's a term that got used many, many years ago, language awareness.
Yeah,
I think is a better phrase to use than grammar. I mean, technically, grammar is just around the sort of structure of the language. Yeah. Language awareness is understanding language as a phenomenon, as a social phenomenon in all its different forms. So much more geared towards practical communication.
Yeah,
so on as well.
And I think what you're getting at there is almost a little bit. We term it. We've termed it recently as disciplinary literacy. The idea that actually what we're really trying to teach when we're teaching pupils disciplinary literacy, for example, in an essay, writing a hypothesis statement and a topic sentence and all those things, we're trying to teach them language awareness, aren't we? We're trying to teach them and trying to make them aware of how an expert lives, thinks and breathes in this field. And I suppose that's what you're trying to get at there, really, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. And, grammar has, unfortunately, over the years, and in the hands of the wrong people, it's become synonymous with sort of correctness and prescription and proscription. And it's not, our book isn't about that at all. Quite the opposite. We argue vehemently at the beginning that this is not about teaching people to say or write the right things. I think if you reframe that, and an ex-colleague of mine, Ursula Clark, puts this really well in a book she did a few years ago, where she argues that we should be talking about registers, not grammar, and register is a really neat term in linguistics, because it's all about the right form of language for the right context. So there's no wrong form of language. It's just that some forms are better for some context than others. Mm. So if you can teach students about the importance of register, that's a really good place to start. So we kind of, that's the angle we took, that we weren't, this was a book about getting things right or telling people, that they're wrong. It was a much broader understanding of what language awareness, language knowledge could be in a school context.
We have at Bedrock, we have a system, we have a core system that focuses on vocabulary and grammar. And our grammar system is what you might call a mastery-led curriculum, where the pupils will take a holistic assessment at the beginning, and it will give teachers really granular feedback about what you term there as the correctness element of it. But then what pupils do is they work their way through sequentially through a curriculum where they learn about independent clauses before they're taught compound sentences and things like that. So we've got the correctness bit in there. But I think what we're trying to do as an organisation is we're trying to ask senior leaderships in particular and heads of faculty to join their thinking up about what might this look like across a school. So it's not just about having the platform, oh, where you're green, blue, whatever it is. Actually, what does this look like in the curriculum across the school? So what are your thoughts on what register, if you're talking about that, what register, what disciplinary literacy, what are your thoughts on what that does look like across the school? How would a school start to go about doing that, do you think?
It's a really good question. I guess there are different demands in different subject areas. I mean, I've just been having a conversation here at Aston actually about this, that, you know, everything is mediated through language. There's not one single activity that we do as humans that isn't language mediated in some shape or form. And I guess subjects are like that as well. Every subject is effectively, it has its own language. has its own discourse and its own specific needs. You know, you have to learn how to write like a scientist to do science well.
Yeah.
You have to understand how, history reports are put together, how chronology works, how to tell stories to do history well. So I guess, and again, we touched on this a bit in the book, I think, or Jenny did in the parts that she wrote, you know, getting different disciplines to understand they have their own, let's call it grammars, if you want to call it that, is really enabling for students and important, because you can't, you can do the sort of practical bits of the scientist, but actually a big part of being a scientist is developing and working with a particular style or register of language. So getting good at that is really, really important. And I guess schools have to know that. I mean, maybe this is going back before your time and some of your listeners' times, but there was an initiative in the 2000s under the new Labour government called Literacy Across the Curriculum.
Now, well, do you know something? When I've worked in schools, as obviously until fairly recently, you go into like dusty old cupboards there's sort of languishing there.
But of all the things that went wrong with those national strategies, and lots did go wrong, the actual materials were really, really good. And one of the central tenets of those materials was that literacy isn't just a thing to teach in English. And really, literacy meant language awareness, really. There was the onus, and I think there still is the onus on different subjects to play their part in developing, generic language skills and language awareness, but also specific ones that are required for their subjects, because that's how you breed the next set of historians and scientists as well. You get them to think.
I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but I remember being at school and I was always really verbally good at English. I was always really kind of, probably to the annoyance of my classmates. I used to come up with ideas all the time and I loved discussing. My teachers fired my imagination and my interest for these things. I remember being like Mice and Men, Romeo and Juliet. And I remember just somehow getting better marks in that subject because I wasn't particularly bright. I was sort of middle of the road, sort of, just under average in terms of where my class was. I wasn't, top of the class, but my passion and my love of what I did carried me over the line. And I suddenly started just getting better grades in that subject of English naturally, which is probably why I am where I am now. But then I'd go to science and it's quite sad, really. I've always had a really natural interest in science, but I was always on paper useless at it. No one ever kind of really sat me down or taught me in a lesson how a scientist writes, what a write-up looks like, how this piece of key knowledge links to the way that this report should be written. It was never codified and I think there's a wider point about what you're saying here about, and we talk about it all the time, Bedro, about the democratization of knowledge, because I was naturally English and that carried me through. I wasn't at science, and this is how you breed the next kind of generation of scientists, historians, by codifying, by teaching register, and by helping as many through, bring them into the club as possible. It's quite an emotive subject, really, isn't it, actually?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, two things to add. In a book I did a few years ago, I called, again, I'm using these terms interchangeably, language awareness, knowledge about language, grammar. I called it the great leveler, because I do really think it is. I think you can mitigate against what you're saying, which is that, you know, some students will naturally, you know, if we're comfortable looking at literary texts because they have that natural disposition, or perhaps because they're getting the support at home, or you know, there's something in their favour that enables them to do that. But I think if you learn even a little bit about how language works, and I'm talking really here about, you know, sort of literary linguistics, stylistics stuff that I mentioned at the beginning, you could do a tremendous amount with just that little bit of knowledge, and it really can, you know, be that leveler. And I fundamentally, if you had to pin me against the wall and say, what is the one thing you believe in, I believe in that. I really, really do. And I've seen it happen as well. You know, I see that happen in schools I've been in. I see it happen with my own students here at Aston. The other thing is, yes, the thing about the registers and different subjects. I mean, again, one of the things that the strategy tried to do 20 or so years ago was to introduce, and this is an idea that originally came from Australia, the idea of you know, different academic subjects as different genres of writing, really. And so you learn about those genres, or you use the word visible, which is a really good one. You make visible what those genres of writing and speaking look like. And to make visible, you have to do that in explicit linguistic terms. And that doesn't mean you have to know lots and lots of very difficult, complex things, but it does mean you need a systematic and transparent meta language, which is why I despair really when I see on social media people moaning the fact that students are using the word noun in an essay or verb, or, and I think, well, what do you want them to use? You know, they're using a word for which there is a definition that everybody kind of knows and understands. It's clear, it's precise, it's transparent. It's exactly the kind of thing that you want students to be doing. And so that visibility, making visible, opening up how things work, and equally when you're writing yourself, being very clear and transparent, are really good things to have.
Something I've been thinking about over the last few weeks since I've joined Bedrock is part of our role is to kind of work with teachers, work with schools about, you know, making sure that there is a really clear plan in place, and that, you know, it's not just about an edtech platform that you use as homework and then off your toddle. It's actually about how you can bring that explicit instruction into the classroom. It's interesting that you say that actually there's a lot of things that actually got missed from that early, you know, about the literacy strategy that actually got missed and we could still be using now. I mean, where do you think we are now as a country when it comes to this stuff? What do you think, you know, in terms of our ability to teach this stuff? And, you know, where have we been brought on, do you think, by this disciplinary literacy discussion? Do you think we're in a healthier state now, or where do you think we are?
English generally.
In terms of, I guess, what you might term, what I initially began this interview talking about grammar, about technical accuracy, language awareness, register in schools, and teaching pupils about what that looks and sounds like.
Yeah, I think it's still a complex picture for lots of different reasons. So I'll try and sum some of them up. Mm-hmm. I think modern linguistics now knows an awful lot, a lot more than it did 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago. And so there's some really exciting work going on in terms of what we know about language. And equally, there are some really good people, some good linguists who are very interested in education and making their knowledge applied. I mean, thinking of people like, you know, Debbie Myhill, for example.
Yeah, I love her work, her grammar for writing work, really helpful.
It's fantastic. And that's a really good example of actually, you know, using what we best know from linguistics to support outcomes, student outcomes, and teaching and learning in writing, which of course is such an important thing. And she's done it in a way which isn't around rules and prescription and so on, but has opened up you know, knowledge about language more generally. So that's a great example. Mm-hmm. However, I think there still is that Langlet split, that Langlet problem, as I've called it before, that compartmentalization. Some of that is the fault of universities. In fact, I'll be as bold to say a lot of that is the fault of universities who continue to offer degrees in English that are effectively English literature, although the landscape has changed, thankfully.
It's interesting.
Since I was an undergrad, but it's, you know, still the case. And I think, you know, one of the unfortunate byproducts of that, and this is not the fault of teachers, of course, is that you still have a significant number of teachers coming into posts in schools who have no background in language at all, and have simply done degrees in English literature. So, you know, in the same way they might feel uncomfortable teaching maths or physics, they're not going to be really comfortable teaching aspects of language. So for me, that's the real central problem, and it's peculiar actually to the UK. It doesn't happen right. In other countries as marked as this. It really is a peculiar phenomenon that's mm-hmm. that's UK centred. Until we get over that, until we see English as an integrated subject that has elements of language, literature, film, media, drama, you know, in its broad and wonderful diversity, we're always going to come up against some of these problems that we've found. That said, again, you can see I'm sort of jumping backwards and forwards.
No, I think that's fair. I like the idea that you're saying there about bringing it, making it a more cohesive offer. Yeah.
Yeah, it has to be. That's about subject identity. And there are people in the subject community, both in secondary and higher and primary education, who have wanted that to happen. Some people have wanted that to happen for years. But also, you know, there are, and this is what I often reflect about what's different now, sort of looking from the outside on the secondary teaching world to when I was a secondary teacher. And what is really different is that you have got brilliant people. You know, Jenny's one of them. Heidi, you mentioned, you know, Heidi Hughes, you mentioned a while ago as well, you'd interviewed on this program. You have got these really top people producing really good books and resources, and you know, you've got events like Research Ed and Lit Drive, Team English, those sorts of things that just weren't around when I was around.
Yeah.
I mean, it was I had a relatively very impoverished diet
as
English compared to what's on offer now. So that's the good news. The good news is you've got brilliant people in the subject community doing brilliant stuff, inspiring, you know, really inspirational people. And then you've got, you know, I suppose groups of or bodies or groups of
organizations,
organizations. That's what they've been around for a long time and have done tremendous work and are still carrying that on as well. So I'm thinking of
Nate.
The English and Media Centre, Nate. So the landscape is good, I think, and it just takes a bit of sort of joined up thinking at a higher level to. You know, a government level, really, DfE level, to sort of help us reconceptualize this subject for the 21st century, because at the moment this compartmentalization is really difficult.
Yeah, I find it interesting. There's a couple of things there. So firstly, I wholeheartedly agree with what you're saying about subject identity and those people that you mentioned specifically, because my English teaching was light years, you know, it was miles away from where it got to by the end, for what that's worth. Things like, you know, hypothesis statements and literature essays, topic sentences, analysis, evaluation sentences, how to actually phrase a conclusion, two-part conclusion, you know, bits that are going to help pupils tick boxes for exams, yes, but actually help. I mean, I had, by the end of my time in teaching recently, I had pupils who were what you might call lower prior attainers who were able to say Shakespeare, a positive, writing in the Jacobean era, comma, uses Macbeth as a vehicle too, and conceptualizing it at that higher level. And it wasn't just because I taught them that sentence structure. It was because I taught them what an appositive was. It was because I taught them what a subject was and what the predicate was. And I taught them all those things. And the function of that language was so important, not just to you know, trot out a sentence stem, but actually because they had a deeper understanding of what the authorial intent, what they were trying to achieve. And I think secondly, and I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but if we were to bring some of this insight, you know, this to a more cohesive offer, I think that we could help, we could support young people into becoming much more kind of discerning language users when they read newspapers, for example, when we have this era of fake news, we have this era of disinformation, disinformation, someone else's news. I accept that completely. But I just think if we're looking at language, we're looking at those brilliant terms you have in English language A level, like positioning, presupposition, you know, those really nice technical elements. They're not just a term to get higher A1 in an exam, but they're actually tools through which you can interpret what's going on in your society. And I think that's the big place we're missing at the moment.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's, you know, that sort of critical aspect is absolutely vitally important. I guess from the, you know, the language bit of that is that you're right. Language is it's highly patterned, actually.
Mm.
You know, you can look at any text and look at if you know what to look for, you can see patterns, and patterns create meanings. And so that's, you know, that's for me, that's always been the positive thing about teaching what I do at university, which is stylistics, which is all about that, which is all about encouraging students to see how texts are patterned and what those interpretive effects of patterns are. And if you do it the other way around, of course, you can also argue that that's useful for their own text production, so that they are writing critically and writing carefully and thinking in, you know, how, and again, this comes from some of Debbie Myhill's work. She talks about, you know, language as putty, language as choice, and they're really quite important ideas, actually. You know, in any decision, any linguistic decision we have, we can choose one word or structure over another, and those aren't often arbitrary. They're often done for very particular reasons, and they often give rise to very particular effects. And that's all about, again, this visibility, this making things open, this sense of, you know, teaching students to see the value in precision and having a systematic knowledge of how language works, and not just around structures, but around some of the stuff that goes on around the outside as well.
And that does not happen overnight, does it? That needs to be, you know, almost linked to the question from before about what the curricula look like over a long period of time. Yeah. What's a child's, you know?
It's historical as well. I mean, grammar, I'm using these terms interchangeably, so apologies. But, you know, language awareness, grammar, stop being taught in the 60s. For good reason, actually, because the kind of teaching that went on before that, and there were some great examples, you can still find some of the 50s textbooks online, were just simply pointless. You know, label the noun in a sentence, label the adjective in a sentence. You know, made up sentences that nobody would ever use. And you know, research showed that these sorts of teaching methods had no impact at all on learning outcomes. And what unfortunately happened is that the whole thing just got thrown out completely. And I guess that coincided with a lack of interest in education from university linguists. That didn't really change until the late 60s, early 70s, with some really good initiatives that went on in London. Some of your listeners may have heard of Michael Halliday, for example.
Yeah.
And his Schools Council project in linguistics. But again, it's if you've got generations of teachers who haven't studied language themselves, it can be really, really hard to pick it up even at a later age. So a lot of the initiatives in the 70s and 80s were well intended, and actually the materials are superb. And some of these were off the back of a number of, you know, government reports, such as the Bullock and the Kingman report. But, you know, I still think it was generally patchy. I went to secondary school in the 80s, mid 80s, late 80s, and I had no language teaching at all. And I don't, you know, that's only really changed, ironically, incredibly ironically, with the advent or sort of return of grammar teaching at Key Stage 2 in 2011, 2012, yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? And this stuff is real, and it does impact people, because when I went to university, I went off the back of doing language and doing about discourse analysis and power and child language acquisition and all the stuff that you've written about in your books. I've studied some of the stuff that's definitely that you've written. But then when I got to university, I had a good few months of getting an academically bloodied nose, because it was really hard to start thinking about Noam Chomsky and grammar trees. And it was, oh my goodness, syntax. I used to dread those things. And yeah. I was that part of that generation who grew up on everything, let's just interpret everything. But actually, you need the technical knowledge in order to make the interpretation, which is why, as I say, genuinely, I'm extremely interested in that Langlet A level that perhaps I'm sure you've had some work, you've done some work on that, haven't you? I think using linguistics as a way of interpreting and looking at those texts as a real living, breathing thing, I think that just fascinating. Could you give us before we finish, an insight into that in terms of how that looks?
The Langlet spec?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. If I may, can I just step back and just say a tiny couple of other things just about...
Absolutely.
The first thing is, you know, I said ironically we got returned to some grammar teaching at primary school. I mean, that really is a good and a bad thing. It's good because you have got students doing that explicitly now and coming into secondary school with some language awareness, which, you know, is an opportunity for secondaries to build on. It's bad because the tests are not good at all and are really a return to the sort of 50s style of pedagogy and testing that I've criticized earlier. So it's a difficult thing, and there are people who feel strongly in both camps about that. The other thing to sort of mention, of course, is that you mentioned A-level English language, and I'll say a few bits about that before I talk about Langlet. It's wonderful to hear you know your own interest in that, and that really has been the success, I think, of the last 30-odd years in the post-16 arena. That's the growth of A-level English language from literally being nothing, from being a small pilot study in the 80s to being, you know, growing to at its peak, it had 25, 30,000 students. I mean, it's decreased now because of the, you know, as we all know, the general decrease in student numbers at post-16. But, you know, it really is a success phenomenon, that A-level. And that's down to a lot of people who got that going and, you know, people who worked on those specifications.
It's given me everything. It's given me everything.
In the 90s and early 2000s, yeah. I mean, there's a lot to be thankful for there because otherwise, you know, the future would have looked... Even bleaker than it perhaps does a little bit now. Langlet is interesting because, you know, for me, that's always been my natural home because I've always been a linguist, but I've always had that literary sensitivity as well. And it's just always seemed common sense to apply what you know about language to big collections of language, which are our literary texts. The A-level itself has undergone a number of identities. I mean, originally it was conceived as something, I'm not kidding here, something that people might do on a Wednesday afternoon instead of playing football.
No.
So, you know, do a little bit of sort of English that has little bits of both. And it's developed over the years, again, largely through you know, teachers and other, you know, academics who have been interested in helping it to grow into a version of English that is genuinely felt to be, you know, useful and, you know, of value to students. Unfortunately, it's never had the growth at post-16, even though I think in the last set of reform 7 or 8 years ago, it really sort of stepped up to resemble much more what it's like in higher education at the moment. But I think it's such 100%. English is either language or literature. And in fact, I often hear stories of the course being split up into Lang and Lit bits, where you get one teacher saying, I'll do the language bits, another saying, I'll do the literature bits, even though, and I'm talking about the largest of the awarding body's version of this, AQA, even though when that was set up, it wasn't meant to be like that. It was meant to be as an integrated subject.
It's funny. I heard colleagues at the time talking about that type of scenario. And I remember thinking, isn't that going to be confusing if you start pulling those two elements apart? Because it's literally supposed to be about integration, isn't it? Synergy between the two.
It is. And the point is that, I mean, there are lots of sort of academic arguments for that. I still stand by the central fact that literary texts are made out of language. So Rob Pope, who used to work at Oxford Brookes University, who I know quite well, He always used to say, you know, literature is made of language, not spaghetti. That was his sort So, you know, the problem with conceiving literature in other ways is that it becomes it starts to become other things that are not English. So it starts to become about history, or it starts to become about sociology, or it starts to become about biographical studies. And so that's what happens when you don't see language as central to studying literature.
And I think those, it's important to add actually at that point, feel free to disagree, but I think things like history and sociology are interesting, and philosophy, things like that are interesting lens through which to access the literature. You know, I had all kinds of amazing fun when I taught Christmas Carol and Macbeth, interpreting through a Jungian and Freudian lens and all those wonderful things you can do to start to dig in and understand the characters more. But it's not, it should be that language is the primary vehicle, the primary thing through which you investigate the text.
I think that's a really good way of putting it. The not to you know, discredit those approaches, but you can, I would argue, you can get a much better, deeper understanding of A Christmas Carol by looking at the novella's language than you can from understanding, you know, 19th century history.
Yeah, I think there's bits that help you understand in more depth, but I completely agree. And I think there's so much to be unpicked through what Charles Dickens. I mean, I read it every year. I think it's my favourite. I don't care who says what. It's my favourite book. It's a story that I watched it. I watched Scrooge as a young lad, and I love the story before I love the book, and it means a great deal to me that. And it says a lot to me, that story. And I think I agree that the language is what has always been the glue for that story for me, because there's bits in the films that I heard that I now see in the books. And that's my journey. I wasn't picking up and reading books from the age of three. I've come to it later in life. And I think it's really important that language is the glue that holds all of that together.
I think so. And you look at Dickens, and you can work out why he's such a great writer and what he does, but that's a, you do that through looking at the language, really. We're not saying that Dickens is a great historian or sociologist or, you know, he obviously is a great political commentator, but first and foremost,
he writes really well.
So he's a good user of language.
And I think that's a really lovely place to finish. And you know, sincerely, thank you for your time, because, you know, part of the thing of speaking to, you know, interesting people is that interesting people have got lots to do. So, you know, sincerely, thank you for booking this time in with us and talking to me today. I know this will be a popular pod. So thank you on behalf of everyone who's listening in, and it means a great deal. And yeah, hopefully we'll speak again.
You're very welcome. It's been great to talk to you.
Take care.
Thanks, Andy.